Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. To do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! Advice for a go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. Anthony, how fucking cool are our guests today?
Very cool.
Oh man, I'm so excited. I'm so excited to welcome them back to the show. They are two of the hardest working drag queens in the business. You know them from the Boulay Brothers Dragula, or one of the thousands of other projects they somehow find the time for. That's including writing comic books, to releasing music with Halloween House Party, to touring the world with their live Dragula show, to producing and hosting their Creatures of the Night podcast. And even they got a collab with the video game Dead by Daylight. Like, you can't look anywhere without seeing the Boulays. Last time they were on the show, they talked about some Corn Boys. This time we're going to talk about some other weird Stephen King kids. The focus is going to be shifting to Dr. Sleep. I'm so happy to welcome back the Boulay brothers, Drakmorta and Swanthula. Welcome back to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think we should call it the Queen Cast today, though, right? Maybe that's a little more.
I'm into it.
All right, it's the welcome to the Queen Cast here on the Fangoria Podcast Network.
I have to say, after that intro, I'm like listening to all those things that we actually do. Uh-huh. I'm exhausted.
Yeah, wow.
I was exhausted, and I just read it. So, yeah, this.
I think I didn't bring the proper energy. Very fucking cool. Very fucking cool. The Boulays are here. There, it's all. You know, we bring guests on who, you know, Uncle Steve himself said the thing he likes about our show is that it's about the people that we bring on, and he's just sort of like, I don't know, like the side chorus in a way, or how did he put it, Eric?
Well, yeah, I don't remember exactly, but he maybe it's just him trying to be modest, but he was just like, the less you talk about me, the better. You know.
but this is what this show brings together is people who are exotic and cool and would see me as a total square and never talk to me, but here we are bonding over Stephen King.
Although I would kill to see what if the Boulays like brought us on to one of their shows, like what the hell it would, at least for me, it would be a hell of a challenge for their makeup department. It's like,
oh, I don't know. 3 hours in makeup can do a lot to anybody. So
can I keep the beard? Can I keep the beard?
Surprise! You might have a whole career you don't even know about yet.
Go for it, Eric.
Yeah. Could I keep the beard, or is that like automatically disqualifying?
That's a thing now. Yeah, people do that. They keep the beard.
Oh yeah, bearded drag is absolutely a thing.
Interesting. Okay.
All right.
Eric, how often do you go without
a
beard?
Do it.
You dye them different colors. Ooh. They can match your makeup. But yeah, people do that. Glitter the whole beard. It's kind of fun.
Okay. I'm interested.
Do you ever go without the beard?
I'll have your agents talk to my agents. What was that?
Do you ever shave the beard off?
I used to do like a season where I would like, okay, I'm going to raise the forest and let it regrow, but my hair grows so fucking slow that if I shaved completely right now, it would take me 6 months to get back to where I am now. Like, I have friends that like have to shave twice a day. You know, I've never been that person. I don't know. Maybe I'm one of those low T individuals all the Republicans are talking about, but but my facial hair growth does not.
Suddenly, we're the Joe Rogan podcast talking about low T.
There's a Joe Rogan joke in there somewhere.
Yes, oh my God. Exactly.
Well, and another thing that I want to say is, and maybe we touched upon this when you both came on last time, But one of the great revelations to me doing this podcast and welcoming in people is just seeing how much Stephen King's work and the movie adaptations of that work have meant to the queer community over the years. Like the one to really open my eyes on that was Brian Fuller when he came on and he was talking about reading Salem's Lot at age 12 and getting certain feelings about, you know, feeling like he was helping him explore his feelings there. He mentioned a specific scene where the boy in that movie's tied up by an older, you know, man, the vampire man, and how he's just like, this should be scaring me, but it's actually making me a little excited. I don't know what's going on here.
A little bit of a pervert too.
doing a lot of work there.
We went from the Queen cast to the Judgment cast real fast.
I mean, you're right. The inspiration I think a lot of young queer people got from reading Stephen King is undeniable. In fact, we have been wanting forever to get him as a judge on the show, and we want to build the whole episode around him. So like we would ask the cast, they have to come up with new interpretive looks of his characters just based on the books, not anything visual they've ever seen. So almost like reinterpretations of like, what would the Children of the Corn look like? Or what would it look like, you know, Pennywise? So I hopefully that happens one day, because he does mean a lot to the queer community, I think.
Yeah.
Are there specific characters that you know of that are popular in like the drag community from King's work?
The obvious one, the one that's so just jumps out to me, it's kind of almost common knowledge, but maybe some people don't see the parallel, is Kerry White and Kerry White's relationship with her mom, and just her being received and the way that she's perceived at school. It is, I mean, just replace, you know, telekinetic recluse with young queer person, and it's a very similar experience.
Is there anybody that gets performed, like a character that gets performed?
I think only Pennywise, because a lot of people reference like pop culture things that have pierced mm-hmm. that veil, and I think Pennywise probably is one that's you know, that works today, because there's so many like reinterpretations of, you know, like Welcome to Derby and all that stuff. Like mm-hmm.
Welcome to Derby. You
know. Yeah. Welcome to Derby.
Now you, what is it?
Dairy.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to Derby.
What the fuck am I saying? Yeah, no. Sorry. We had a long night filming last night. I'm a little out of it.
I totally understand. I was just wondering but if yeah, I, you know, I was like missing Pennywise a joke is, or something.
There's, yeah. There are new interpretations of him.
Right.
It's more in the pop culture zeitgeist. So, yeah.
Well, it's also interesting, and this is something we've brought up a couple of times, is that Pennywise presents as male, but in the book, Pennywise is laying eggs. Pennywise is doing, you know, Pennywise, the actual entity, can reproduce. And that's, you know, so that's in a weird way, you know, Pennywise is kind of its own drag show, right?
Yeah.
It's showing whatever it's representing itself, however it wants to be represented, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting you mention those things, because I feel like there are a lot of horror fans that are sort of anti anything, you know, queer coded when it comes to horror, and they sort of miss really obvious markers that you're like, wait a minute, how are you watching this and you don't see the parallels? It's kind of wild to me.
Well, part of the problem I think with King's work in terms of being adapted for drag is that his female characters, especially the most famous ones, are not very ostentatious. It's like Annie Wilkes, who's very, you know, housewife, librarian coded. My wife will kill me for saying librarians are dowdy, but you know, she's a
we're both
very
married to librarians now, by the way, but Rez,
is that true?
My wife just started her librarian job this week.
Yeah. But like Annie Wilkes is very like prairie coded, right? Like very plain Jane. So is Dolores Claiborne. I guess who's the character from Gerald's Game? But what's her name?
Jesse.
Yeah. I don't know if she would be a good drag character. She's just a naked lady chained to a bed, but
I don't know. That sounds like that could fit in Dragula.
But I mean
Kerry White's a great example though, because you know, I think at least from an outsider's perspective, from you know, a cis white dude's perspective of drag, what I appreciate about it and what I see about it is that it's usually a showing of power, right? It's like in all my favorite drag, you know, player, whether it's, you know, people, there are drag queens that are playing Magic the Gathering now, which is something that I've been getting into. And like they, it's all about showing that power and, you know, shirking that nervousness of not representing yourself and, you know, just going out there. And I think Carrie White is like the absolute, like, weirdly enough, she's, you know, she is a great encapsulation of that, you know. And she, unfortunately, when she shows her power, she murders the whole auditorium of teenagers. But, you know, sometimes shit's got to happen, you know?
Yeah, which is also a parallel I think a lot of young queer people wish they could do when they're in junior high and high school.
Right.
But the idea of, like, you know, flames behind you and a bloody beauty queen. I mean, you know, not beauty queen, like a prom queen. That's a great visual. But even Rose the Hat, you know, like you can picture someone interpreting that in a really interesting way, which is something I, you know, just rewatching the movie and looking at it, the look was interesting to me because I felt like she was so hot that it was hard to get scared by her. Like I was wondering, like, what would it be like if you had had a more, you know, an older, scarier looking person under that look? I wonder how it would have sold differently.
Isn't that kind of the whole psychic vampire angle of what the True Knot is, though? Because, like, you know, the original tellings, you know, of Dracula in the books, he's seductive, but, like, Bela Lugosi, when he was cast in that movie, it's just like, oh, you know, there's getting a whole bunch of people are watching that going, I wouldn't mind if he bit me. You know what I mean? And the sexiness of the vampires kind of became its own subgenre. But, you know, it's not always that you get the inverse of that and you have, you know, the female sexy vampire. I guess Dracula
what
has
about
his brides
Dracula's
and all
that, wives but, he's got the three wives.
Yeah, but they were always kind of subordinate, though, weren't they? They always just felt like slaves of Dracula. I guess there were some movies
know, they
where
took
they got
charge
to
of Jonathan Harker pretty fast though.
That is true.
But Dracula's daughter, Dracula's daughter is out there.
That's
too
true.
She was fierce.
She was pretty as I said it, I knew, I'm like, wait, I'm gonna contradict myself in just a second here. But you know, with Rose the Hat, like, I had that same thought though when you watch this and you see Rebecca Ferguson in that movie, and you know, she's walking around with her bare feet and her, like, you know, kind of nomadic hippie-ish, you know, Romani, you know, flowing silken stuff and her cool hat and her piercing eyes. I'm like, you know, I wouldn't mind joining the True Knot, maybe, you know. It's like, I can be your crow daddy.
She, Rose the Hat reminds me a lot of Carmilla. Do you guys know Carmilla?
The vampire story?
The vampire story, yeah.
It's sitting on my nightstand. I have not read it yet, though. I know it's like a classic.
It is a classic. It's 18, I think it's, I forget, it predates Dracula. It's considered to be an influence on Dracula. Mm. Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu wrote it, and it's about a seductive lady vampire moving across the countryside in Germany or Austria or whatever it was called at that time in history. And she takes up with a wealthy family and begins seducing the daughter. So it's sort of very queer popular story, even though it's set in an age of severe repression. I think that was part of the appeal of the story back then. But the story itself is a little dry because it is, I think, the 1870s when it was written. So it only goes so far, but it's been reinterpreted a lot of different ways. I think there was a movie made in the 60s that was an adaptation of it that was really spicy. I think it was called The Vampire.
It's Mad World.
It was called The Vampire Lovers. And that was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
But Rose the Hat reminds me a lot of Carmilla because she's very assertive, very dominant. Rose is, in the book, she's described almost like an Angelina Jolie type character. She's described as very exotically beautiful, you know, with features that are almost alien and otherworldly. And then she puts a, you know, a weird, like, Tennessee tuxedo hat on top of it, and, which is a very she looks very Burning Man to me, doesn't she?
It's so funny. I read somewhere someone was like, oh, Rose the Hat is the type of chick that I'd let ruin my life at Burning Man.
But she's pretty she's a pretty spicy one in the book, and I think her sexiness is part of what makes her scary. Is that it's she's like the in nature, you know, there's this phenomenon where predatory plants are very ornate and beautiful because they're there to lure in the insect, and they want to grab you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, that's I think those wiles don't work on us, so it lands a little differently.
So you would survive the temptation to be
yes.
If you were a little shining child, you'd be like, nah, girlfriend, that ain't gonna
kick
work.
Kick her ass and steal her hat.
But Rebecca Ferguson is I don't know, there's a lot of queer love for her. I see posts all the time, women are falling for her and swooning for her. So I think there's something about Rose the Hat that I think is part of this overall LGBTQ plus community.
I agree. Yeah. Any sort of like female villainous, you know, I think is always attractive to queer people. They love to get behind the idea of like Cruella de Vil and Ursula type character. I think that it is queer coded in that way.
Yeah, and killing some kids is fine as long as she's getting some lunch. You know, that's all good.
Well, kids are annoying, let's be honest.
Especially ones that play baseball, for fuck's sake.
Right.
Fucking exactly. Baseball kids and baseball families. Nah. So let's talk about Mike Flanagan before we kind of dive into Dr. Sleep on the whole. You know, what was your old relationship with Flanagan's stuff? Were you a fan of his work going into Dr. Sleep or not? Like, I'd love to hear, you know, what your guys' thoughts were.
I think what's most interesting is we, you know, there was a time when, of course, we were familiar with Mike Flanagan and his work, but he became part of our kind of close friend group.
Yeah.
And we were playing, it would be like game night and all these people.
At Des Malchin's?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. The Dasmalchians game night with Brian Fuller and the Flanagans and like so many others, like Twin Temple. And it's just like this weird, I mean, it's our version of the knot, the knot in at David's house, where all of these different members of clans like sort of come together, and it's like a celebration of darkness, but game night, and it's totally sober, and we all have like a lot of fun. And we had we have a friendship with Mike and Kate and even their kids. You know, I think more so than his work.
Yeah, so I think we met him and started becoming friends with him on a personal level before we were super engrossed in everything that he did. And we went back and I had seen this film before I knew him, and I was like, let me go back and rewatch this, because it's such an interesting challenge he had after reading about the reception to the original film and the differences with the book and all that stuff, that I was like, let's go back and rewatch it with a fresh perspective. And yeah, I appreciate it a lot more now that I know him personally, because I kind of know his own personal struggles and I can see some parallels there. It's interesting.
I mean, and a lot of that's oddly baked in. He's been on the show multiple times, and he actually did a commentary with me and Wampler for the director's cut of Dr. Sleep, where, you know, it was just us talking through the movie, and we got to shepherd him through his discussions. And I believe he was talking about, there was like one specific shot of, it was just a crane shot in the street or something, and he's like, this shot will always signify the day that it was either the day that he earned his first sober coin or the day that he decided to get sober. I don't remember which one it was.
Wow.
So it's knowing that kind of wrinkle in you know, the creative behind it. Suddenly you watch it and you see Danny's, you know, speech at AA where he's accepting his, what, 6-year chip or whatever for, you know, on behalf of his father, who he knows wishes could have, you know, been up there in that moment. You know, it does. It adds some depth to the thing. But you're exactly right, though, that it's Dr. Sleep is a weird movie. It's a weird book, man. Like, you read that book, and the movie, I think, is one of the examples of a better movie than the book was. And I like the book more than a lot of Stephen King fans do. But
Wampler didn't like it, right? Wasn't that
Wampler
one that
hated it? Yeah, I don't know if he finished it. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that assessment. You know,
you don't think the Well, here I'll make the case in one specific choice, and that is to not do the incestual thing where it turns out Abra's Danny's half sister or half niece or whatever it would have been. You know, in the book, we find out that Jack Torrance, you know, had an affair or whatever, and then, you know, and so he's related to Abra, and that's why she's so strong with the
Force.
Shine. Yeah, I almost said the Force. Yeah, dark which is side. The very Star Warsy thing.
Why did I know you were almost? You were like trying not to say the Force. Geez.
Yes,
it's not how the Force works.
You know, I feel like it's. I don't know. Maybe it's also because I have such an affinity for the Kubrick movie. Mm-hmm. I love the original book. I can look at them as two separate things that I think actually feed pretty well into each other. If you read the book and then watch the movie, a lot of what's in the book you can layer into the thought prod, the stuff unsaid behind Wendy's eyes or whatever, and so it elevates her character a little bit. You know, she's feeling trapped because she doesn't have anywhere to go. She could leave the hotel when Jack's starting to go crazy, but, you know, her only option of a place to go is to an abusive mother who, you know, is going to make her life a living hell, right? So it's like all this stuff that's not text in the Kubrick film could be behind the eyes of, you know, Shelley Duvall if you've read the book, right? So, because I have the affinity for the movie, the fact that that Flanagan's adaptation takes the visual stuff and a lot of the ideas that were known from the Kubrick movie and mixes them with the Stephen Kinginess, the faithfulness of Stephen King stuff, you know, maybe that elevates the experience for me beyond what I read on Stephen King's book. But I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on the you know, on the book and why you would argue against it being the movie being a better adaptation.
Me or our guests?
Yeah. Juana, well, I don't know
Drack
if
Swan.
If Swan and Drack have ever read the book, so I don't want to put them on the spot there.
Sorry, but
I don't read. I'm sorry.
No, it's totally fair. Totally fair.
I just thought it was successful as a book because it's not trying to be a direct sequel. I mean, it's a direct sequel in that these are the same characters, but it's not trying to tell the same story. Like, we're back at the hotel, snowed in again. Right. One more go around with the ghosts of the Overlook Hotel. And, you know, it's sort of the way people complain about franchise storytelling, Marvel, Star Wars, anything that we've gotten a lot of over the years. There's complaints like, well, it's the same story. You know, they're telling just sort of a rehash or a slightly revised version of the original. And I think with this one, he did tell a different story. He went in a different direction with this power, found the same characters. I think he was interested in what becomes of a child of an alcoholic when he grows up. And that story was compelling to me. So I was kind of in for the ride. And I liked that it wasn't all just back at the hotel, but it had enough of that. And the movie gives you a great deal more of that because the movie finds a way to merge the fact that the hotel exists still in the movie universe. It doesn't exist still in the book universe. Right. So
it burns down in the book. Down. So
they go to the grounds. Yeah. And there's still sort of the same basic story occurs. You know, these entities reappear and are useful to help take out Rose the Hat, but it's just I just thought it was an interesting story. I was kind of down for it.
One thing that I do like a little bit more in the book, like Jack Torrance appears as a ghost, a friendly ghost, and helps Danny at the end, and like doesn't he push Rose off of a cliff or something, and or Danny looks up and just sees the outline of his father or whatever. I kind of like that Jack, at least whether or not his spirit still exists in the hotel in the Flanagan version, if that's really Jack or if that's just the hotel projecting that, or if Jack's actually trapped as Lloyd, which is even interesting. I like that it's a darker thing that Jack failed and he's forever tormented here. And I guess it also underlines the whole story being about Danny having the same temptations as his father and moving and going in a different way and making better choices and, you know, and breaking that cycle of violence and addiction and things, you know, I think that plays a little bit more into it where it's not like, oh, and then the happy ghost father comes in to save the day one more time, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there's a lot of layers to this. And so, you know, Drack and Swan, what do you think about the way that the Jack Torrance is angle of this is portrayed in the film?
Well, first of all, I think Mike Flanagan had less of a job of directing a sequel and kind of more of a job as like mediating a custody dispute between like Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick.
So well said. Yeah.
It was like, how do we honor both? Like what an undertaking to try to take on a sequel to something like so celebrated, but then also it has a sort of like convoluted history of like two different forms and lots of people don't read it. So they just take Kubrick's vision as like, you know, as canon and how can you do it all? And I kind of think he does a pretty successful job at that. Now, not having read the book, but I'm peripherally like familiar with it. I think one of the things that happens at the end of the original is, like you said, the Overlook burns down, but we didn't get that in the movie, but we do kind of get a version of that. And the same thing with the redemption of like trying to help Danny, like right there at the end, right. I guess the book, we get that just a sort of a generation later, right? Like in this story, Danny is trying to help kind of defy the force of the Overlook, and ultimately the boiler room explodes and the hotel burns down. So we sort of rectify the story the same way, just like one movie later, which is kind of great.
That's what King likes, is that it kind of brought his ending back around. And
yeah. Right.
When I was like, as a director or writer, I'm like trying to adapt this movie had to give Mike so much anxiety, because you had the original book, the film was so different than the book, but fans love the movie. And probably a lot of them didn't even read the book, right? So then he had to make a sequel to, you know, that answered what those fans wanted. They went wanting to see the Shining film sequel. And he had the challenge of being like, wait a minute, but the guy that actually wrote this story did not like that film. So how do I, you know, put these two worlds together? And I'm just like, oh, that would give me so much anxiety. And I think he did such a good job of it, honestly. He kind of answered both fandoms, merged them all together in a wonderful way. But I would not want to do that personally.
Yeah. The way the process works with Stephen King now is when you adapt one of his things, he'll give you the like a provisional option, and then he gets approval over a lot. And Mike was saying that he got to a point where he had to pitch Stephen King, you know, the idea of like, I'm going to make this the olive branch between the Shining book and the Shining movie. And King was he's like, I don't see how you can do that. It's like, but give it a shot. You know, I guess at this point he'd done Gerald's Game and impressed King enough to where he's like, you give it a shot, but you know, no promises I'm going to sign off on this. And so Mike wrote it his way and sent it off. And I remember Mike had, in one of his interviews with us, was saying how that was one of the most nervous he's ever been sending an email with his, you know, draft of the script to King. Mm-hmm. And King responded with an enthusiastic thumbs up. So, you know, obviously they did that. And then I think he kind of just let Mike go off and make the movie. And then very famously, he took the movie to Bangor, I believe. And I don't think it was in Florida. I think it was in Bangor and sat down with King and in that mall theater, you know, the one good mall theater there in Bangor, and watched the movie. And he had a story where he was saying how King leaned over during the baseball boy scene and was just like, this is a little much, don't you think? And because the director's cut of that scene, by the way, is a little bit longer than the theatrical. It's a little bit more intense.
Uncle Steve is getting soft. Come on, man.
Well, and in Mike's response is like, you fucking wrote it, my dude. Like, I, you know, I didn't.
How many toddlers have you hit with trucks, Uncle Steve?
Yeah. Like, you love killing kids. I've read Cujo, the original ending of Cujo.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen What the Hell You Do with It. Yeah. That's very interesting. But in the fact that I do think that Dr. Sleep, the movie, has kind of softened King a little bit on the Kubrick version, you know. But I also think King for a long time was, you know, a little miffed there was a period of time right when The Shining came out where it wasn't really well received. People didn't like it. It was kind of a joke of a movie. They didn't get the over-the-top performances and whatnot. But then about a decade after it started, or I guess a little bit less than that, I think it's when it was hitting cable and stuff, it started establishing itself as a cultural icon of that moment, and then it kind of superseded the book in a lot of people's minds, right? So I think he was a little miffed on that, you know, that, you know, because people come up like, oh, the twins in The Shining scared the shit out of me, or and all this stuff. He's like, that's not me. That's not my shit. Like, I didn't write that. That's all Kubrick. So, you know, I think he got a little upset that the identity of this thing that was so personal to him was, you know, co-opted by something that he didn't like to start with, and now he keeps getting it thrown in his face. So I think it took him a while to get used to it.
Well, it makes sense, but I think Mike did a perfect job of healing that wound.
Right. Have you seen the theatrical cut and the director's cut, or just one or the other?
Yes, we watched both. We just watched the director's cut in the last 2 months or something like that, I think. Yeah, that's the one we most recently watched.
What's your feeling? Which one do you like the better?
I think the director's cut.
Yeah.
Personally, yeah. You guys too? Yeah.
I think it changed. It's weird because it's one of those director's cuts, like one of the Lord of the Rings films feels like this. I don't remember which one, to me, where the theatrical cut feels longer, even though it's the director's cut's like half an hour longer than the theatrical. Mm. There's something about the way the director's cut's paced where it feels shorter to me than the theatrical, even though it's significantly longer. I think it's a far superior version of the movie, for sure. What about you, Brez? What do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know. We always have to, like, describe things as superior or, you know, it's totally an enjoyable thing. I love the way you talked about I think it was Swan who mentioned that it was like a custody dispute.
Mm.
And I think it's a great flick. You were asking me about whether the director's is better than the...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's superior because it's more depth, but I don't know. Like, I also think if I only saw the director or the original cut, I'd be fully satisfied with that. I think the director's cut works as, like, I don't know, if you're craving a little more and you're really into it, but I think that this is where I get pulled in two different directions on, like, which is superior. I think the version that was released to theaters was the version that should have come out in theaters.
Mm.
And the version that they do the extended thing on, which I think debuted on HBO, right?
Yeah, it was in, like, one limited edition. You could get, like, a fancy edition Blu-ray that had it as an extra bonus disc, and then it was on HBO, like...
Yeah.
That's the only version you can actually see, I think, if I remember.
Is that the only one that's available now?
I don't know if it's now, but I think at the time it was the only way you could watch it is that director's cut. Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. I think that's... I think that the director's version is better enjoyed as a second viewing. And so it's hard for me to say which I think is superior. I think, because I do think there's something to be said for tightness of storytelling and sort of the lean, visceral... fast-moving narration or narrative. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think the version that came out in theaters is the one that should have been released.
Yeah. I don't think that there's a difference between the cuts where it's like Blade Runner, like one of them is clearly better. You know, it's not like one of those things.
Yeah,
but,
that's what I mean. It's like, I don't know, it just feels like a little extra.
It's hard for me to go back and watch the theatrical now. Like, to me, it's like the director's cut's the cut that I put on if I'm rewatching it.
I was my mind was distracted a little because I was thinking about twins. You mentioned the twins aren't part of the novel; they're part of the movie. And Swan and Drac, like your drag personas, are they twins? Are they considered
sisters? Not twins.
Yes, sisters, not twins. Exactly.
But they look you have a very similar look for both of them, right? And so I wondered if
it's like I think we'll do a little bit of difference here and there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're very similar.
It's iconic, you know what I mean? It's like it's something that sears into your brain. It's probably why people gravitate toward the twins in the movie version. Mm-hmm. You see that and it just leaves its mark. So that was absolutely by design years ago when we started developing, like, you know, these characters that we eventually become. And now it's so weird because a number of years ago we crossed over. My real name is so rarely used. Like, even the people that I work with, the camera crew, like our podcast staff, like friends, like they don't even know my first name, which is kind of wild.
Mm-hmm.
kind of. I was in that boat for a minute. Like, everybody knew me as Quint in my Ain't It Cool days, and I would have my friends would call me Quint. It just became a nickname. Yeah.
Well, Eric, isn't it right? I forget the name of the actresses, but the girls that played the twins in the movie, mm-hmm. they're not actually twins either, are they? They're just sisters.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they're just sisters. I don't know. Although anyway. they look so identical.
But that's the thing, is if you dress alike and you're sisters and you're not, that's there's true. Only a few years difference, like, you know, you can, there's like a twin motif. What is it, Swan and Drac, about doubles that like, it's, that are enchanting, and but also it's a little unsettling to see those two girls at the end of the hallway, but there's also something enchanting, like we're sort of captivated by twins.
I think it has a presence, the power of mm-hmm. presence of just the duplicate, you mm-hmm. know, people seem to respond to that. But I think also there's a little bit of, to me at least, carnival freak show, like, what's happening here? Are these people the same? Are they, you know, it's kind of that right. vibe, and it just makes people unsettled but also attracted to the image,
which is the evil one, right?
That's always the question, right? It's the juxtaposition. Oh, they look so similar. And then when we joke or we cut each other or, you know, we're out murdering somebody, it's like, oh, who's the evil one? Who's the sweet one? And we love to play with.
Yes, the fans love to argue about which one of us is actually the evil one. It's yeah. been discussed on Reddit many times.
and you're like, both.
That notion of being mesmerized by two reminds me of this joke from The Simpsons, where I think Homer is dressed up as Krusty and Krusty is there too. And one of the gangster characters comes in and goes, I got to check my eyes. I'm seeing double. Four Krustys.
I mean, it's a popular genre trope, right? The whole double thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got the sisters, you know, the very well, that's a De Palma. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, people that look similar. I mean, fuck, you can go back to Psycho, right? Even though that's not quite sisters, you know, one an old dead skeleton and another one a weirdo taxidermist in his mom's clothes. You know, it's like,
you close know, enough, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, I think that there's something about the human brain that's like programmed to find patterns and things, and so I think it just trips us up a little bit whenever we see two of the same thing, you know?
We detect
patterns.
Well,
I think what he's trying to say is you would be the dead hag and I would not be. That's what I think. That's what I get.
Shots fired.
I made no such claim. I want this on the record.
I don't know, Eric. I kind of thought that's what you were implying too. I'm gonna throw my co-host under the bus.
I was talking about in genre how there's just always, you know, this repetition, this going back, this split image or whatever, you know, that's the Jekyll and Hyde. I don't know. There's, you know, there's it's a fairly you know, popular thing of.
Maybe it's that our primitive brain is used to identifying other human beings as individuals. And so when there are two and our pattern recognition kicks in, we go, oh, this is unusual and unsettling. And I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're touching on what I was going to say a couple of minutes ago. You know, we're so programmed, like, you're unique. There's no one quite like you. Like, when you look in the mirror, no one looks like you. And I actually grew up around a lot of sets of twins, oddly. Like, I knew a lot of twins. Some of my best friends were twins in high school. And I think that there's a power to it. There's like a underlying doppelganger vibe, like good, bad. Is this a copy, a double? I think it taps on like a primitive nerve that we have in our brain that tells us, ooh, danger. Like something is wrong.
Like, am I going to get tricked? Am I going to, you know, be one of those videos where the husband comes in and swats the ass of his wife's twin sister and, you know, like whatever, you're, you know, vice versa. And also, did you grow up near a nuclear power plant or?
No, I did not.
Okay. It just luck. Cool.
Interesting story. My great grandfather was one, you know, he had a twin and he married his wife. My great grandmother was also a twin. So yeah, it's odd. Twins run in my family. Like my uncle, my two nieces, they're twins, identical twins. So it's kind of interesting.
And Drac actually did grow up next to a nuclear power plant.
But I killed my twin.
Absorb your twin in the womb. Yeah. Like the dark half.
Right? I'm the powerful one around here. We're only going to get paid one fee, you know, so I might as well.
The world can only handle one Drac. Apologies to the twin. So let's talk about The Shine and how it's portrayed in this movie. It's fairly powerful. It's really interesting how, to me, you know, kind of the stakes have to go up in a sequel, right? And I do like that, you know, part of this is a battle of shine between Rose the Hat and Abra, right? This young girl. I think one of the, if I had one criticism of the film adaptation, and I think it's reflected a little bit in the book too, it's just that Abra is so goddamn powerful, right? Mm-hmm. There, when I watch this movie, there's very few times where I feel like she's in real danger from these people. What do you guys think? Do you think Abra is a little too superpowered, or do you think that she's, you know, evenly matched by the True Knot's evil, you know, at least the level of evil they have.
I agree with you. I think it's too powerful. Like, untrained, like, where's the Professor X in this, you know, this arrangement? Because someone needs to kind of shepherd you into that level of control. Like, when she's setting traps for Rose and, like, that psychic escape and, you know, rummaging through her memories and her cathedral mind, I'm like, that's advanced Omega level mutant stuff that I don't see this little girl having mastery over quite yet.
Here you go, Swan, on the record, Abra Stone is a Mary Sue. Gotcha.
I mean, kind of, right? I'm never a fan of that. It's like, okay, yeah. Talking about the X-Men, like Jean Grey, they're just in the Spider-Man movie that just came out. It's too much, you know? It's kind of like, to me, it's too much. That's just my opinion. I like, I think it's more interesting when someone's under actual threat or danger, sort of. But I mean, Abra is in this movie because she's not fully developed yet and she's being preyed upon by Rose. So I don't think it's a Mary Sue situation in this. But yeah, by the end, she's certainly too powerful. I don't know where you would go with it after that.
Rez, you think she's overpowered or underpowered or just as powered as she needs to be for the story?
I don't know. Like, it's the Mary Sue claim to me, I guess there are probably examples of it where I'm like, yeah, this character didn't quite earn whatever their power was. But I think it's that notion of like, don't tell me about the childbirth, just show me a picture of the baby. Like, at some point you just want your heroes to get on with it. So, or, you know, the main character of the story has to get on with it. So yeah, I think she definitely comes to it with a kind of instinctual understanding of how to wield this power. I don't know. It didn't throw me out of the story. So I guess I'm gonna allow it.
Yeah, and you know, I think the actress is really great in this role, and I like that when she represents her power, she's using her pop culture things that she's into. Like, you know, she shows up with an anime wig or white eyes or, you know, or the blanked out face, but with that crazy wig on or whatever, where she looks like an anime hero. If you notice, all the stuff on her walls are all like Ruby and, you know, these, you know, like Japanese animation kind of influenced things. And so I do kind of like that. Maybe that's where she just goes from the pop culture I'm consuming. Maybe I can do this, and you do it and like me when I tried to jump off the couch and fly with a Superman cape on. It didn't work because I don't have any powers, but you know, maybe that's the thought process as a kid. You just see something and you try it, and she can actually do it because she's powerful.
No, but everybody has powers. Everybody has something that they're really good at.
Flying is not one of mine. I can
flying
tell.
Is yeah.
Couldn't do it. I tried.
Keep trying. Maybe you need to move up to higher levels.
Yes,
so that there's
I'll try
greater
the roof
consequences.
Next.
You know, if you're a good singer or you're a good guitar player or you're a good dancer or you're a good actor or writer or you're good at some sport or track and field, swimming, whatever it is, you have a proclivity for it. And then there's also a combination of training. But I can tell you, as somebody who played basketball for like 6 years, I sucked no matter how much I tried to improve. I just wasn't good at that. But when my teacher gave me a theme to write using 25 vocabulary words, I was really good at it. I could write a story using just random words. Like, do you guys ever have to do a project like that where you just have to use certain words and, you know, write an essay or something? I made up a little fictional story, and nobody really trained me except that I was a big reader for years and years as a kid. So I guess I sort of, that's a bit of training, but I was just good at that. But like my first time out, not perfect, not publishable by any means, but just good. And it didn't matter how many times I tried shooting free throws. I sucked. I never got any better and I hated it. And so I think the Mary Sue of it all is like, if a character has a talent, it's just like any one of us who has a skill that's natural and you build upon that with training, but you can still start out kind of far ahead of other people. Does that make any sense to you guys, Swan and Drac and Eric?
Yeah. I definitely get the concept. I think for me, as you know, I write a lot of fictional stuff myself. I just find more interest in characters that are maybe less powerful than the average, right? I think the struggle's more relatable. It makes them more, I don't know, more fleshed out, I feel like. It's hard for me to get excited about a character who I think cannot really be threatened.
No, I agree with that. You got to have some, they have to leap from somewhere to somewhere.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe they should have put her in a basketball tournament and then I would have balanced it out.
Well, I think that a lot of the water in the movie that, you know, or the scene that's supposed to carry this thought of Abra's in real danger is the baseball boy scene. Like, because I think that's the whole purpose of that being in there beyond just a plot, you know, device to get Abra, you know, kind of on the radar of the True Knot. Because it's also supposed to show the audience, and I think it's the reason why Mike went so hardcore with it and unflinching, and why Jacob Tremblay, did the whole nine yards and really sold it. And I think that it's supposed to be brutal because it's supposed to be like, here's a kid. Kids aren't supposed to die in these kinds of movies, and if they do, we don't see it. And oh my God, we're not cutting away. You know, we're having to watch this. And I think the underlying point of that is to show that you do not want these people to get their hands on Abra. And that is what could be her fate, especially when Rose gets all pissed off. You know, I do like she gets all confident, gets up on her little RV and crosses her legs and like, I'm going to go fuck this girl up, and just gets, bitch slapped across the astral plane. Right. And she comes out and she's like, oh, I'm going to fuck this girl. We're going to kill the fuck out of this thing. You know? And she comes out like, we're going to bleed her. We're going to hold her and feed off of her steam for years. And we're going to really, it ain't going to be quick like Baseball Boy was. So I think that's supposed to be the thing that really makes the audience scared for the main character. I just think that she's just shown to be so competent and so good at what she does and so cocksure about it too. She's not even like unsure of her own self. She's just like, oh yeah, whatever. I'll walk through your image on the road and you know, your little mist cloud. I don't give a shit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe that's it.
Look, that scene is terrifying, and I applaud it. I applaud everybody involved for taking it that far, because we don't see children hurt, and it's not. And it's the same thing with kind of animals too. Like if there's ever a dog in a horror movie, I always clench. I'm like, oh my God, please no. You know, it just speaks to us, I think, as humans. And then when you saw the brutality of that, I was like, okay, yes, the stakes are high, and I think that was the effect.
Well, it's also interesting the way he shoots it. The stakes are on Jacob's face, Baseball Boy's face.
Yeah,
you know, it's you get a little blood splash under his chin or whatever, but you don't get an Art the Clown scene, right? You're not seeing guts being pulled out and you know his chest getting ripped open and all this stuff. You're not seeing it, but you are seeing what it's doing to him on the face of. You know, at the time, that was just like America's little boy, right? He was in everything, right? He's everybody's son, everybody's nephew or whatever. And here he's
Jackie Cooper, America's boy.
Yeah. He's the oldest boy. No, you know, one, the casting of that is perfect. And the way that he plays it is perfect. And the way Mike shoots it is perfect. Like, I just think that again, if it had gone for the gore of it all, it would have cheapened it much in the same way that I think, you know, to me it is cheap when, well, like in the latest Evil Dead movie, like they kill the dog and they don't just kill the dog, they like viciously stab it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like I'm out. This is it's just lazy to me. It's lazy. Yeah. It's cheap. I don't want to see it. The effect that you're getting from it to me is just a cheap shortcut. It's not, you know, it's not you being edgy or like serious, you know. There's you know, I don't know if there's a way that they could have done the dog scene like the baseball boy scene. And I don't, maybe it's just me. You can kill kids all you want, but leave the dogs alone. I don't know. Maybe that's just, you know, a thing for me.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Me too.
We can all agree. Fuck them kids. Leave the poor animals alone. Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, like you said, it was effective in showing the audience what a threat these people were. So right. I get why they did it. I think it was well done. And you're right. If it had been an Art the Clown moment, it would have cheapened it. I think the best, most effective horror is when you don't necessarily show the audience what's happening, but you inspire them to think their own horrible things that are probably worse than what you would have even shown. And I think that's a more effective way of storytelling.
The performance mm-hmm. is what sells it, and that's all you need. Yeah. You need the anguish on his face, the guttural screams. It's like that's way worse than, you know, seeing a K and B effect or something, you know what I mean? So have you seen the other Mike Flanagan Stephen King things? Have you seen like Gerald's Game? And
I have not. We haven't seen Gerald's Game. I've seen a bunch of his other stuff. I actually have seen, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, Carrie, the seen all of that.
Yeah.
Ooh.
You've seen all of it?
We did. Yeah, it was so cool. Like, Mike rapped. He got back into the country, and he's like, okay, watch party. He has a theater at his house. So there was, like, eight of us, and it was – I was like, this is, like, the coolest thing ever. Yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah, his theater room has a bunch of props in it and stuff. Yeah, he let me come. He showed Life of Chuck to me in that room.
Was it just a marathon screening of all the episodes, or?
Yeah, literally, we started with breakfast, and then we watched all day. Like, we didn't wrap. It wasn't. I was gonna say we didn't wrap. We didn't wrap till dinner time. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's a binge I'm very excited for it. I know that the reception of like some of the early images that came out, people are unsure what this is, but you know, to me, that makes it more exciting. You know, I just, you know, the last thing I need is just we've seen four different versions of Carrie that's just the same version, maybe told slightly differently. So I'm excited. I think that there's some landmines, and if it wasn't Mike doing it, I might be a little nervous about it, but to me it's exciting, you know, when Mike's saying, oh, I'm gonna give you this and honor what King did, but do it in my own special way. To me, that's a green light, not a red light.
I think people are going to love it. And he's the perfect person to do it, even like what we're talking about. The fact that he was able to come on to do Dr. Sleep and do it the way he did and honor the original book, but also the film that people love, came to love. And, you know, I think he's proven that he's the perfect candidate to handle it.
Well, I'm excited. You know, maybe we'll have you back on when Carrie comes out. We can talk about Mike's Carrie adaptation. So before we wrap up, what are you all up to now? What's next for the Boulets? What's
the latest?
Yeah. So we're in finishing post production for season 7 of our main show, The Boulet Brothers Dragula. We're finishing the deal on some new iterations of it that are, I think, we're probably be announcing in the next month. It's actually, believe it or not, it is the 10-year anniversary this October of the first day that Dragula premiered. So 10 years has went by really quickly for us, but so obviously that's going to be a big milestone to celebrate. And we're really prepping for the Halloween season. You know, we're very much associated with Halloween and the Queens of Darkness and all that. So we have to put out lots of content, specials, all kinds of stuff, live events. So we're kind of in the background hibernating. We probably seem like we're dead from the outside world, but we're just, you know, working behind the scenes, building all this stuff so that when the season hits, we can unleash, you know, a lot of entertainment to the masses.
Yeah, that's the thing, is you gotta you, like all the Food Network shows that are like, here's the Halloween Bake Off and stuff, they film that shit in like March.
Yep.
You know? Yeah,
exactly. There's a
long runway to get that shit up. All the Christmas stuff, you'll see like pictures of them filming the Christmas thing at Disneyland like in August, you know. And it's like, you gotta have a runway. You can't just make that shit happen. You gotta,
I know, we had to do that time for our Christmas special we did last year. I was like, it was like 110 degrees or something out, right, and we're, you know, in the desert filming. I'm like, this is really weird.
Yeah, it's just Christmas in the southern hemisphere. That's just how it is in New Zealand and Australia, right?
So. Well, that in particular, speaking to what we're talking about, we shot the B-roll the year before at Christmas time because there would be no way to get it, you know, when neighborhoods were actually decorated. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. You really did have to think ahead.
I really appreciate you guys coming on. You are welcome on the show.
Thank you. Yeah.
At any point. I love hearing your thoughts on genre. I love hearing what you're up to. I love you casually dropping, you've seen the latest Stephen King thing and I haven't, and making me feel all shitty about myself. And like, this is, you
that's
know,
what you
like,
get for comparing Swan to a dried up bag of bones.
I guess so. I inadvertently,
happy we could do that for you.
I crossed that. So, but I love talking to you both, and I love your place in the horror community. I love the inclusiveness and that you bring to your work and to genre as a whole. So I am always excited when we have a chance to speak. So next time you have anything you want to promote, you're always welcome on the show.
Well, thanks for having us. We always we had a blast the last time we were here talking about throwing kids around and Children of the Corn. And this time we're also talking about killing kids. So I think we're going to get a little bit of a reputation.
Yeah, I was going to say we have to play it out right now. What's the next dead kids Stephen King thing that we can talk about?
I mean, fault. He's the one that writes all this. We're just talking about it.
I mean, there's lots of dead kids in it. Yeah. There's dead kids in Cujo.
Welcome to Darby.
We could do a whole episode just based on the standpipe scene.
Yeah.
And Welcome to Darby. Yes.
A lot of kids died there too.
A lot of dead kids in Darby Dairy. So I don't know.
Did you guys like Welcome to Dairy, by the way? I want to ask you that.
Yes. Yeah. I was up and down on it. Like Brez and I, we did our own like little watch along show with it where we were kind of going episode by episode, and Brez had me beat a little bit because he got to see a big chunk of him, and I'm going episode by episode going, well, maybe this happens. And he's like, well, maybe you'll see next episode.
Maybe.
But I was a little, it almost shook me the whole military involvement in Pennywise and them knowing about it. But I think they resolved it okay. And pretty much when Bill Skarsgård and Pennywise gets to become a real part of the show, I think it really soared. And so I'm the back half I very much appreciate. And I think it earned it. I think the guy playing Dick Halloran fucking ruled. I think I loved what they did with his character.
Chris Chalk.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was really great.
Right.
Now, what do you think?
So yeah, there's lots about it. I ended up loving that kid group that ended up being the main group. Mm-hmm. I do like the rug pulls where you think you know what the friend group is, and then the end of the first episode's like, fuck you, they're all dead. You know, like again, dead kids. I would give it like a 7 out of 10, maybe. You know, I have some issues with it, but I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. What about you guys?
No, I thought it was really fun. I have a huge, a huge ability to give people tons of room when they reinterpret or reapproach something. So I'm not someone that's like, I'm going to compare it to this, that, and the other, and it's not quite this, and it's not quite that. I was like, this is its own ride. I'm getting in the car. I'm putting on the straps. I'm ready for the experience. And I like where it took me. I thought it was fun. And I enjoyed that retro obsession with the supernatural, like you mentioned the military kind of like trying to just, it was very, it's very kind of World War II vibes,
like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Trying to harness
very
the occult.
So I thought it was it led into fantasy and horror and fun, and I enjoyed it.
I am curious what they're gonna do, because I heard there was a sequel. The sequel is green lit, and I'm like, okay, wait, what time period are we going to?
They're going to the 30s. What is it, 35?
Really?
Yeah, they're going backwards. I think each one is supposed to go back the 27 years
or
whatever.
So it's sort of a gangland. Yeah. Like, it's the era of the Bonnie and Clyde and Babyface Nelson. So there's the gang of bank robbers who end up in Darby.
the Bradley gang, but also one of the things that's exciting, not to keep you guys too much longer, but is the whole concept that was introduced at the end of that season about Pennywise existing in all time at once, and how that how that confuses him, you know, the entity a little bit. He's like, oh, wait a minute. No, I actually do know what's going to happen. And, you know, I know what's going to happen to me in 30 years. And, you know, like, I love that concept. And I think them keeping going back in time is really interesting, especially if the entity kind of knows what's going on in front of, behind, and, you know, in the future for it. I think that's a really cool thing, and it's something kind of unique to a horror villain, especially one that's an icon like Pennywise is. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty interesting and deep thing to give your baddie.
I agree. Yeah, I'm excited to see what they do with it. We both enjoyed it. I asked you because I had heard a lot of Stephen King fans were like not loving it. So I was like, I don't know. For me, I thought it worked. So I was curious what you all thought.
And it stuck the landing. I think that ultimately, you know, that's the important thing is I think that it ended very strong, and I think it's really cool. And listen, even if some of the stuff that I didn't like that happens earlier on in the season, I still couldn't fully, you know, embrace just the fact that I gave a shit about that those kids and the people at the end of the series when I feel like it was strong. I wouldn't have felt that way if that setup hadn't been there in the earlier episodes that I thought weren't as on the mark. So I think taken as the whole, I really dug it, and I'm looking forward to whatever the Muschietti's throw out for the next season. So all right, so thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you guys, and we'll have you back on as soon as humanly possible.
Thanks again.
Later.
The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.